This is Our Presence, The Answer, a monthly show on Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College, the coordinator of the Freedom and Captivity Initiative, and I'm your host for this week. This show explores how we keep our communities safe and asks the question, are prisons the answer? Today, I'm continuing my conversation with Representative Grayson Lochner about housing and prisons and the relationship between them. Grayson is currently in his second term in the legislature, and he serves on two committees, the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee and the newly created Joint Select Committee on Housing. So in our last episode, we were talking about the relationship between houselessness, policing, and incarceration, and the sort of feedback loop between all of them. And we were talking about why we live in a society that's willing to invest between 4 and 8 times as much in policing and incarceration as we do in housing. What that says about us as a society, what it would take to kind of reverse that expenditure and that investment, what it would take to keep people out of prison, what it would take to give people stable housing. So we're going to continue that conversation today. So Grayson, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine. Excited to be here.
So I'm going to start today's episode by quoting some statistics that were prepared by Mark Van Sickle, who is a member of the Colby College Justice Think Tank. We referenced this think tank in our last show. It's a think tank comprised of 12 incarcerated and formerly incarcerated scholars who have been working all year on a research project related to restorative pathways to reentry from prison. And they've identified the lack of housing for people reentering prison as a major barrier to successful reintegration. At a presentation last month at the National Alliance for Higher Education in Prison, Mark reported that formerly incarcerated individuals experience homelessness at a rate 7 times higher than non-incarcerated individuals. And this number jumps to 13 times higher for those who have been incarcerated more than once. Additionally, he reports that 3 times as many formerly incarcerated people are housing insecure than are homeless. So clearly, housing is the major barrier to a successful reentry from prison, and thus a major contributor to recidivism, which is the return to prison because of committing a violation or a new crime. So, Grayson, how can we understand this? Why is finding housing so difficult for people reentering society from prison?
Yeah, I mean, housing, I think, obviously is harder for people who have been stigmatized with a criminal record. But housing's hard for everybody currently. And it's people who have never committed a crime in their life are, housing burdened and housing insecure, and sometimes find themselves in a situation where they end up justice involved because of that insecurity. That makes it harder on everybody. And I think the people who experience the brunt of it are the people who have a conviction or a felony or some kind of a stigma. And there's really we don't have systems in place to help them. We say we have a corrections system, quote unquote corrections. I think fundamentally that means we should be helping people to correct their behavior in some way or find, ways that they can succeed in society. Like, isn't that what it means to have a correction system rather than just like a punishment system? Shouldn't we just call it a punishment system or incarceration system rather than a correction system? And obviously the correction system isn't supporting people in building lives independently of whatever crimes they committed, whether they're just crimes, so often is the case with like nonviolent drug offenders, people who are experiencing mental illness and act out in some way. Those crimes, do those really have victims? Like, sometimes they do, most of the times they don't, and people end up with a record. And that's a huge part of it too. But just the fact that there's so much stigma and there is not, that we don't have any systems. Corrections ends for the most part the day the person leaves the prison or the jail and they don't have any support. Maybe they're assigned a social worker. Maybe they're told, And what social workers end up doing so often is just referring people to other social workers. Hey, I've got another social worker in this another agency who does this thing. And then you got to go talk to this other social worker in that other agency who's going to do this. But they don't actually, so often they can't help materially. Navigating all those complex systems is just so hard for somebody who carrying around trauma or carrying around, experiencing symptoms of a mental illness, or somebody who just doesn't have a dollar in their pocket and they're out on the street trying to figure it out. It's damn near impossible. Like when you don't have support systems, when you don't have a family you can rely on, when you don't have privilege to fall back on, these are the realities for people. And we just society or what, you know, the narrative out there is that it's their own fault. They did it through their own volition and circumstances. They aren't victims, they're victimizers. And therefore, you know, we're fine with keeping them stigmatized and marginalized. And it doesn't do anybody any good. I mean, I think most people end up in the justice system were at some points victims before they committed any, you know, whether their crime had a victim or not. And then, you know, then they become victims again. So like, that's not the prevailing view in society. The prevailing view is like, they're bad people and they're bad people willingly.
It's almost like we've created a revolving door situation where somebody has a tough situation that may, you know, lead them to commit an infraction of some kind. And if you think about what happens to you when you go to prison, you lose everything, right? You lose your house, you lose your job, you lose your car. For many people, you lose your community, you lose your connection to your friends. Many people lose their families. You often have to, you know, pay a lot of money and fees associated with either fighting your conviction or sustaining yourself while you're inside, because everything while you're inside still costs money. You still have to pay for, you know, your toiletries, extra food, to try to support your family, et cetera. And so people coming out of prison often come out with nothing more than the $50 that they're given by the state upon their release. And if they need a bus ticket, the bus ticket is taken out of that $50. And we wonder why people can't get themselves back on their feet. And what's astonishing to me is we live in a society that metes out punishment and tells people, this is your punishment for the infraction that you've caused. But then we don't have the term of their prison sentence and their punishment, right? When they get out, we make it hard by including the stigma in their record, by forcing people to go through background checks, by enabling people who have felony convictions to be kept out of all kinds of social support programs, basically guaranteeing people that there is no way you're going to make it after prison because we're going to make it so incredibly difficult for you to get back on your own 2 feet again. There are a lot of barriers to housing for people who have, for example, felony convictions about where they can and cannot live, who they can and cannot live with. And so this stigma that you're talking about is baked into statute and policy. It's a set of policies that we enact that keep people from being able to live flourishing lives of dignity and success. And that says something about us as a society and about our willingness to invest in punishment over support structures that keep people out of correction systems in the first place. I really appreciate also, Grayson, that you bring up the difference between having a Department of Corrections and a Department of Punishment. We have a Department of Corrections. It metes out punishment. It carries out the punishments that have been inflicted by the courts. But then we don't offer any sort of pathway back into society that's supported in any sense because we think people have committed a crime and they should be punished, it seems. What would actually make a difference? In the presentation that I referenced, Mark Van Sickle shared some examples from elsewhere in the country of programs that assist people reentering society from prison with housing in the recognition that it behooves all of us, it's in all of our interests to invest in ensuring that people coming out of prison don't end up back in prison again. In other words, what keeps our communities safe is to ensure people coming out of prison actually can regain stability in their lives. We're not doing that in Maine yet, but there are a lot of places in the country that are doing that. There are places, for example, that have an office of reentry services out of the governor's office or out of a mayor's office, where their explicit job is connecting people with housing and with jobs. Mark gave the example of New York's Exodus program. This is a program, a public program that purchased hotels in the New York City area that currently house 864 residents after their release from Rikers Island. So I'm curious about other ideas or other programs that look good to you that we might take an example of for Maine that might provide housing support for people reentering society after prison. What looks good to you from the national
level? Absolutely. I mean, I love the idea. The state had the opportunity during COVID to purchase hotels, which some states went ahead and did. We were housing a lot of people during the pandemic in hotels using federal money, which was given to states. And the state spent, through the course of COVID, like upwards of $300 million for housing people in hotels. And we saw, you know, I'd been saying I saw, at least, I can't speak for anybody else, that there was a cliff fast approaching when it came to the end of COVID relief, where all these people who were staying in hotels who had been homeless or experiencing homelessness, where that relief was going to run out. And then where are they going to be? They're going to be camping out during Oaks Park. They're going to be camping out in park and rides. And that's exactly what happened. We've seen a proliferation of these encampments. So can't say it came as a huge surprise when that money ran out. But what the state didn't do is we didn't take any of that relief money and purchase hotels that were like on an ongoing sustainable solution. And that's just, I'm just talking about for people experiencing homelessness. I'm not talking about for people with like a record specifically. But then we have this whole other, like I see that, you know, the housing crisis like affects people coming out of carceral settings way more acutely than it does everybody else, but it's affecting everybody in some capacity. And so just looking at the whole, you know, there's just not enough housing out there. The state is, by 2030, we're going to be 80,000 units short. We're building something like 1,000 units a year, and those aren't necessarily even sustainable, you know, so we're falling way behind. We're falling increasingly far behind for everybody, you know, and for low income people who can like get their hands on a housing choice voucher, which is probably denied to a lot of people who have been incarcerated. Oftentimes they're on a wait list for 4 to 6 years to get one of those vouchers, and then they can't use it because there's no housing available to them. There are myriad problems and crises embedded within the greater housing crisis. And I think everybody can see it from their perspective, from where they're sitting to some, you know, in some capacity. So what other states are doing, like I would be very much in favor of like buying some motels, having some kind of public option for people transitioning out of incarceration. The only drawback to that approach that I see is that, you know, you end up with people all with the same background, oftentimes with the same ethnicity, like, you know, you end up with racially segregated, low-income places where people, you know, like, there's this idea of like community integration for people, especially with like a mental illness of some kind. Like their best route to living like full lives is through community, supported community integration. And I don't really draw a line between that population and people in it who have experienced incarceration, and increasingly like they're the same population, because we don't have the supports out there for people with mental illness. So yeah, hotels are one option. Like one thing that I would really love the state to do, there's no such thing as public housing really anymore. It's all gone into nonprofit, but most people agree that there is some role that the public sphere should play in addressing the housing crisis. Like the public, like a public developer to some people sounds radical, but to me it's like there are other states that are doing this, and it's like one of these things that's done like routinely internationally that for some reason the U.S. like is a bridge too far for us. But there's, you know, one place in the country currently that creates this type of housing through public funding. And it's the Housing Opportunities Commission of Montgomery County, Maryland, which creates like beautiful, like mixed income housing. And these places have amenities, and they, you know, some of them have pools, some of them have gyms, they have, you know, daycares, and they have laundromats and things, and their whole communities. And it's all built by the county, and it's mixed income, where a certain percentage of those units are always reserved for people making, you know, up to 50% of the area median income, which is considered like very low income. So if we had a developer like that, that wasn't exclusionary, that could, you know, it could help integrate people regardless of their background into communities where they could rebuild their lives. But we currently don't have any options available like that. But I mean, the public has a role to play. And, you know, I mean, the only investment that we made so far is in prisons. And there's one place in the state of Maine where you can go and you're guaranteed a roof over your head. You're guaranteed 3 hot meals. Maybe they're not good meals, but they're meals, where you can get health care. Maybe it's not good health care. You can even get an education and a job. And that's prison.
Yeah.
Like, but there's nowhere else you can go and be guaranteed those things. So why don't we just build those in the community rather than behind bars?
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe stop harms from happening in the first place that way.
Exactly.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah. Hi, this is Justice Radio. Today, we're talking with Representative Grayson Lochner about housing, prisons, and the relationship between the two. This is the second of a two-part series, and we are learning a lot. So Grayson, last question. Here in Maine, we have 6,742 formerly incarcerated people who are still on probation. And we release from prisons every year somewhere between about 800 and 1,400 people per year. And that doesn't include jails, that's just prison. In looking over some statistics, Maine's 2023 Home Fund received about $42 million to alleviate homelessness. And the Maine State Housing Authority received $16 million. Curious where that money went. How are we actually spending those funds?
So the home fund, there's actually like two programs in Maine that are called home. And the one I think you're referring to is administered through Maine State Housing. And that money is collected through the real estate transfer tax, which in Maine is one of the lowest in the country. You know, it's something like, it's like literally 0.5% or 0.45% on any real estate sale, regardless if you're buying, you know, a $20,000 camp up in Aroostook County, or if you're buying a $5 million mansion on the coast in Freeport or something. So, you know, it doesn't matter. It's the same percentage. And that money goes to the home fund and means the Maine Housing Authority has a lot of discretion over how they use that money. Oftentimes it's used to leverage like this low-income housing tax credit program for developers to build, you know, temporarily affordable housing to certain income brackets. That's the primary way they've been using it, as far as I could tell. Or they can use it for what's called like bridge financing, where if like a developer comes forward with a proposal that they think they could create a bunch of affordable units, but they just can't make the financing work, then Maine Housing could say, oh, here are some money from the home fund to finish this project. It could be used in a lot of ways. Maine Housing could use that money virtually any way they want. I think they're kind of in this one mind frame of like leveraging the tax credit programs to low-income housing developers. That's one method of doing it. I would like to see them, you know, fund a public developer. I would like to see them, you know, create vouchers for people. I'd like to see them do a lot of things. So that's where the home fund. One great thing that we did this last term is so previously half the real estate transfer tax went to the home fund and half of it went to the general fund, where it could be used for like anything else that taxpayers pay for. What we did this session is we took that other half that used to go into the general fund and put it into housing first programs. So those are for people who have been chronically experiencing homelessness for 10 years or more, to get into housing situations where it's not contingent on them maintaining sobriety or, you know, maintaining work or anything like that. And routinely, people with stable housing situations are, you know, they have better outcomes in just everything, whether they're drinking or not, whether they're, you know, so housing first. So we've invested in some housing first programs using the rest of the home fund. So I'm excited about that. That other $16 million that you're referencing, I think is going into emergency shelters. So Portland built a $22 million emergency shelter in 2018, you know, sort of breaking at the seams already. And we've had, you know, a huge influx of like refugees and asylum seekers that the city's, you know, doing more than its fair share to address. But we're addressing a statewide homelessness crisis as well, because Portland is one of the few cities that's like stepped up to do its part. And there are other cities that are actually like prohibiting the development of emergency shelters, period, which is hampering the entire state. So I have legislation about that this year too, that would prohibit certain municipalities from from doing moratoria on emergency shelters. So I think that money, that $16 million that you're referencing, is going into emergency shelters and supporting those and the development of new ones. Shelters are necessary, but they're also not a solution to the crisis. So we really do need long-term solutions, like systemic solutions. And that's why one of the things I've been so adamant about is creating like a mixed income, publicly owned in some capacity, housing developer, because that currently doesn't exist. And that would give the state or whatever entity, you know, it could be municipally owned, it could be county, or it could be some state agency that, you know, develops housing, and it could be mixed income, and it could be really nice, like Montgomery County does. It's worth noting that there, you know, besides the prison, there's one other place that the state does develop some mixed income, nice, publicly owned housing, and that's the university system. And the University of Southern Maine just bonded for $70 million to build these, you know, the Portland Commons dorms. And that's mixed income housing for students. And it's great. You know, I mean, you look at those buildings, they're modern, they're clean, they're sleek, and like centrally located. And you can get really affordable rent there if you're a student. So, you know, if we can do that for students, why can't we do it for the public?
Yeah, but you can't live there if you have a felony conviction, even if you're a student.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's the problem.
There's a barrier there. So I want to list back what I'm hearing from you, because what I'm understanding your complaint to be primarily is that we don't invest public dollars in housing. And instead, we kind of we take a neoliberal approach where we try to incentivize other folks, like private developers, to do low income housing. We help them with bridge loans, or we do these housing, these tax credit programs that really
well said.
Well, yeah, really only provide housing for low-income people for a limited period of time. And so what I'm hearing your solution is a mix of investing more in these sorts of more kind of neoliberal options, as well as a public option. And so investing in a public developer, giving a bunch of money to a public developer to build projects, but also creating vouchers for people, which then they take out on the open market. Also, it sounds like you'd approve a hike in the real estate transfer tax and have that home fund to then be redistributed to developers in the way that they see fit. Is there anything else that you would propose?
Well, I think just, you know, the reason why I think we need to use the existing tools that we have, just to give a little history lesson, like the U.S. actually used to do public housing, like during the New Deal era. And for a while there, it was very successful, and it was almost the victim of its own success, where we used to create like mixed income housing for that was publicly owned. And it was like nicer than the housing that people could get on the market at the time. And so people ended up having a real issue with that, like namely developers and real estate companies had a real problem with the government being able to provide better housing and cheaper than the private sector could. So it was a victim of its own success. So then it became very income segregated and racially segregated. And then like the story of public housing is by, you know, the 80s when it was kind of, they became these places of like concentrated poverty and desperation and like racially segregated. And that's not a place we want to go back to. But the solution to that isn't just to get rid of public housing. It's to make it better, so make it mixed income with amenities and things like that, where they're very nice, livable places like Montgomery County has done. But the two programs that were intended to replace public housing were, you know, the Section 8 voucher, the Housing Choice voucher, which we talked about, and then the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit program, which incentivizes developers. So that is that neoliberal approach that you were referencing. And the only reason I say, like, we shouldn't, We need to use those programs because that's what the federal government has given us. They're the tools at hand that we're provided with. So we can't just say we're not going to use them. But I think what we can do is create solutions that aren't dependent on federal programs, that wouldn't compete with dollars for those programs. And that's what a mixed income developer could do. Where actually those, because it's mixed income, it's actually like a revenue generator, because one of the primary arguments is like, oh, who's going to pay for these expensive social safety net programs that you're proposing? And well, hey, the great thing is with housing is that people are going to be spending a percentage of their income towards rent or towards ownership eventually, which could be done within a public housing developer. And because it's mixed income, you can keep the rent lower than the market rate and there's no profit motive. The idea is to create housing for everybody. And so therefore the rents stay low and they're sustainable and it's a revenue generator because you're funding it through bonding. Like you're taking out a low interest bond.
I was going to say, what I love about what you're talking about is where we started the program in last month's episode, that you got into politics, you got into policy because of your commitment to community, because right. your desire to find ways to invest in rebuilding the kinds of communities that keep people safe, that nourish human life, that offer dignity and support to people who live in. And so this portrait that you're giving us of your vision of what we should be doing to ensure stable housing is very much that. It's very much ensuring things that sound to me, you're not using this language, but it sounds to me like multi-generational, multi-racial, across class differences, and incorporating people with justice histories and those who don't have justice histories into the same living environments in ways that are supportive and humane. And that's
right.
That's the society I want to live in, Grayson. I don't know about you.
That sounds great. Right. Just look at like what places like Norway and Scandinavia have done, where you look at even like their prisons, where the maximum sentence you can get is like 20 years for anything.
Yeah.
There's a method. We could go into that whole thing, but those like prisons look nicer than a lot of our market rate housing does. And, you know, and they have all these outside supports too, and they don't have the types of, you know, like they just don't have the problems that we have here. It's because they made a commitment to like supporting people where they're at rather than forcing them into these, you know, incarceral systems.
And because they want people to be successful when they get out, they don't want to see them back in prison again.
Right.
Bring our show to a conclusion. Thank you so much, Representative Grayson Luckner, for joining us. Next week, please join Marian Anderson for Voices of the Directly Impacted on Justice Radio. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and to Lucas Brown, our sound engineer. I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.